Welcome to Saints and Sinners Unplugged. I am Pastor Ken Jones, joined by our regular co-hosts. We have Aldo Leon from Reconciled Church in Homestead, and David Menendez, Tamiami Baptist Church, and Jose Prado from Christ Family Church. We are four local pastors that get together at this time each week to talk about various aspects of reformational theology, church history, and things of that nature. We are delighted today to have a special guest joining us, longtime friend and colleague in various endeavors, Dr. Ligon Duncan, who is the chancellor of a Reformed Theological Seminary. Thanks for joining us, Lig.
Hey, Ken, thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you again and good to meet new friends.
Yes, we've been talking about this and the possibility of us coming together and having this discussion, so it's finally happened. We really appreciate you being with us. Now, Lig, you are recently, you've been appointed as the Chancellor of Reformed Theological Seminary, and this is after how many years as senior pastor?
I served at First Presbyterian Church in Jackson for 17 years as the senior pastor. And though it still feels recently to me as the chancellor. I've been the chancellor for 7 years at RTS.
Oh,
I was appointed in 2013. And what they say is the days are long, but the years are short. I mean, it has flown by. I still attend First Presbyterian Church when I'm not preaching somewhere else. And I preach about 3 Sundays out of the month somewhere. I'm sort of a circuit rider now,
sure.
Ken.
Well, hey, you know what? And I could always see you in the academy, but all else aside, you're a great preacher.
Well, I love preaching and I learn so much. I know you feel that way. That one of the greatest privileges of my life is that people pay me to study the Bible. And
Amen.
So I feel like a kid in a candy shop during the week preparing to preach a sermon, because it's exactly what I want to do. I want to be learning the Bible, and I want to learn it well enough to teach it well to the people of God. And so every week for me for preparation it's devotional work for me. And I'm sure you feel the same way when you're preparing messages.
Oh, absolutely. Well, here's where I want to begin, because right now, in evangelical circles, those who lean towards reformational theology have an increased presence and voice. And that hasn't always been the case. For, I would say that really the shaping of modern evangelicalism probably more than anything has been influenced by the Second Great Awakening and even the growth of Pentecostalism and so forth. So there was a long stretch where those who were historically Reformed have been somewhat the minority in the greater evangelical hodgepodge. Now, there have been a few efforts over the years, collaborative efforts over the years, that I think have contributed to increasing our profile among evangelicals. Yeah. One would be the Council on Biblical Inerrancy, whose primary goal was to reestablish the authority of Scripture among confessing Christians. And in that group, we actually had David Wells on a while back, and of course he was a significant part of that, and R.C. Sproul, James Boyce, and a few others. And then a number of years later, some of the same ones that were involved with that established the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, which was inspired by the works of David Wells. And I don't remember exactly when you joined. I think I joined in 97. I think you must have come
about. Yeah, you were before me, Ken. I was later. It's like 98, 99, somewhere.
Yeah, so you were, you were there before Boyce passed, though. You were there. So you were a part of that. And again, that was a collaborative effort. And the primary purpose there, and eventually you became the president of BASE, correct?
That's right, in the around 2004.
Yes. And at that time, the Alliance was largely confessional Reformed Christians. And the effort there was to recapture the essence of the gospel. And sort of out of that, you also had the Gospel Coalition. And that is, it's a little more inclusive. And again, so you have these three major movements that have kind of put Reformed theology and certainly the proponents of Reformed theology on the bigger stage among evangelicals. How do you see that trend?
Well, I mean, I love the picture that you've sketched out, Ken. I think that's right. And I think if I can put even further background on that, if we had been around in the latter half of the 19th century, though there would have been profound Reformed theologians in various parts of the culture. You know, if you went to Princeton, the Hodges would have been there, and then eventually Voss and Warfield and people like that who continue to have major theological influence today. But they were not the leading voices of Christianity in the culture. In fact, even in their own time, they were considered sort of a little off to the right. They were the right wingers, the old schoolers, and the Christianity had a it had been very much influenced by revivalism in some parts and by theological liberalism in other parts. And at the beginning of the 20th century, it was sort of the heyday of theological liberalism. So cultural liberals that or theological liberals that were wanting to influence the culture created an instrument like the Christian Century. And you, know, you can even hear the optimism of that in the title of that publication. And they would have been the ones who were in New York and Washington and that people knew about. And then I think one thing that happened was when the neo-evangelical movement began in the mid-20th century, a lot of the people that were at the core of that neo-evangelical movement had at least Reformed soteriological leanings. You know, they may not have understood confessional reform like you and I do, but they very much were influenced by a big God theology in the doctrine of God, in the doctrine of salvation, in the person and work of Christ. And I think of people like Carl F. H. Henry, who very much had an influence on these later movements that you were just talking about. And Henry, through Christianity Today and a variety of other activities, attempted to bring to bear a more robust, historic, confessional, evangelical theology. He shared the theological commitments and convictions of many people that would have been identified with the fundamentalist movement in the first part of the 20th century, but he didn't want to silo culturally. You know, he wanted to see Christianity have a broader cultural impact. And of course, he was very closely associated with the Billy Graham movement and was for a long time sort of a theological advisor to Billy Graham and then later to Chuck Colson, you know, who was a part of some of these movements that you have just been naming, the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy and then the Alliance and things of that nature. And so you have, beginning in the middle of the 20th century, for the first time, people that are self-consciously Reformed having influence in the wider evangelical world. And there's, as the world is secularizing, and I'm not sure people realized how we were secularizing in the 1950s and 60s. You know, people point back to the 60s as the time of secularization, but my heavens, the 50s. And the, and right after the war, after the Second World War, there's as much secularizing going on in the culture. It may look like, you know, Leave It to Beaver, but there's as much secularizing going on in the culture in the 50s as there is in the 60s. And in that context, if you're going to if you're going to make a case for Christianity, you better have a robust theology. You know, you better have a robust doctrine of creation. You better have a robust doctrine of humanity. You better have a robust doctrine of God. You better have a robust doctrine of salvation. And these guys were quietly influencing and laying the groundwork that I really think came to fruition in the days of Dr. Boyce and Jim Packer and Francis Schaeffer and R.C. Sproul, late 60s, early 70s, Battle for the Bible, that kind of stuff. That was being, the groundwork for that had been laid for 20, 25 years. And those men then were on the scene when that particular discussion happened. And that, of course, led to the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy that Dr. Boyce took such a lead in, R.C. Sproul took such a lead in. And that's the part of the group that we got to be a part of in the 1990s. They were, in the 1970s and 80s, very active in that ICBI, International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. And I really think that's one of the things that mainstreamed confessional reform theology into a multi-denominational environment. I think what happened was when the rest of evangelicalism was looking around for who are the people that are going to defend the Bible,
right,
everybody that they ended up looking to were confessionally reformed. Let me quickly, because you'll appreciate this, we got to tip our hat to our Lutheran friends, because there were some good conservative Lutherans out there battling for the Bible too. Our Concordia Seminary friends in both California and in St. Louis, we could name a lot of those folks that played.
Yeah, the Preusses.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, just amazing people that were a part of that conversation with the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. But as evangelicalism started looking around during the battle for the Bible, everywhere they turned, it was Calvinists. It was confessionally reformed guys. And I think that's one of the things that led to this proliferation. I don't think anybody necessarily realized it was happening in the late 1960s and 70s, but I've seen it now, Ken, wherever I go. Wherever I go around the world, I meet confessionally reformed Christians in a variety of countries, ethnic groups, denominations, who have been influenced by these movements that you were just talking about. And I really do trace it back to those movements, what we're seeing right now.
Well, having mentioned that, yes, certainly the impact is especially recovering the authority of Scripture, et cetera, the reliability of the Bible. Many evangelicals jumped on board, and the Reform folks are the ones that were kind of behind the scenes working through these things. But certainly the people that would have been a part of that council were really kind of small in comparison to the bigger face of evangelical Christianity. Many fundamentalists that would claim the authority of the Bible, but would deny the importance, because hold in mind that we're also talking about maybe three, four generations of those who have come out of no book but the Bible, no creed but Christ.
Yep.
But they did resonate with the emphasis of establishing the authority of Scripture. So the Reform folks were kind of in the background putting these things together and giving us the voice and the speakers, but they represent a small segment of the bigger stage of evangelical Christianity.
Yes. That's absolutely true. And I think it's the law of disproportionate influence there. Our friend and mentor, Jim Boyce, used to say evangelicals think that they're able to accomplish more than they're able to accomplish in 5 years, but they underestimate what they could accomplish in 20. And Boyce's life is a testament to that. You know, in the 1970s and 80s, figures like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson would have towered above Jim Boyce in cultural recognition and influence. They would have been the ones in the newspaper. They would have been the ones in the magazines. There is no question that Jim Boyce's influence, real lasting institutional influence, is 10 times the size of those men. And it will continue to grow on and on and on. And we could go down the list of those kinds of people, Ken, though they represented small denominations. I mean, Jim eventually came into the the PCA out of the PCUSA, the Northern Presbyterian mm-hmm. Church, after it had united with the Southern Presbyterian Church. They took the escape clause and came into the PCA. But even the PCA today is less than 500,000 members. It's a tiny, tiny little ecclesiastical body. If you want to find a big group of Presbyterians in the Western Hemisphere, you've got to go to Mexico and to Brazil. That's where it's happening for Presbyterianism. It's Spanish speakers, it's Portuguese speakers. They are far larger than we are in the United States. And let me say, very happily, there are really good things happening in confessional Reformed circles all over Central and South America. And but the PCA is fairly small. You'd think if you, I think the Southern Baptist Convention has something like 16 million members, if you could find them. And the PCA is, you know, just a tiny percentage of that. And yet there's a disproportionate influence when, you know, when you take people that are part of, whether they're part of Dutch Reformed circles and they embrace classic confessional theology, or they're part of Baptist circles that relate to historic Baptist confessions, or congregational circles that relate to historic congregational confessions, those people have a disproportionate influence in what is actually happening around the world today. So there would have been a lot of people who didn't know the name John Stott or J.I. Packer or Jim Boyce or R.C. Sproul in the 1970s. But when I land in Cape Town, South Africa, or in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or Jakarta, Indonesia, those guys are far more influential, thank heavens, than Joel Osteen or Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell or any of the you know, the people that often by the media represent, you know, what their take is on evangelical Christianity.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned before, R.C. Sproul. R.C. is to be commended for making reformational theology accessible, even in circles where they may not be in full agreement with the confessions or with all points of Calvinism. But he introduced some concepts to a broader audience, and I give him credit. I know Boyce was significant in publishing, and he had his own media, but R.C. used various platforms to really saturate his audience with important concepts that were germane to reformational theology.
Absolutely true. And that's, you know, I think that's another interesting thing that happened, Ken. If I grew up as a teenager in the 70s, and the dispensationalists were still the best popularizers amongst the more substantial sort of interested in Bible exposition kind of evangelicals, you know? Right. And what happened is when Sproul came along, he actually taught a whole generation of Reformed people how to explain accurately but compellingly and clearly Reformed theology to a larger audience. And God raised up a generation of people who have been doing that. And so now the popularizers are Reformed. In fact, one of the interesting, I recently had my leadership team at Dallas Seminary, and we were meeting with their faculty members. And one of their faculty members, we asked them several interesting questions. One thing we said is, how dispensational are you? And the answers were really interesting. We asked that to students, and the student's response was, what's dispensationalism? But the faculty responded by telling me how many of them were going to PCA churches. And I thought, the world changes, doesn't it? You know, that's not what you would have heard 50 years ago at Dallas Seminary. And so I agree with you. I think RC and others started popularizing Reformed theology so that it actually got places where denominationally and ecclesiastically you didn't have confessional Christianity.
Well, with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, which came later, you had the Cambridge Summit in 1996, the emphasis there was, I think, twofold. One, the content of the gospel itself and the importance of the historic confessions of Protestantism as a means of defining us. And at that point, again, you know, we had a gathering of people who were committed to the historic confessions and so forth. And we took on various issues at the time. So let me ask you, as it relates to your work, number one, with ACE, and then later with the Gospel Coalition, what would you consider to be the central issues that you took up in that regard in defending and defining historic Reformed theology?
Well, if I can go back to the Cambridge Declaration in the early days of the Alliance, I think one of the things that the Alliance was saying was that evangelicalism, by and large, was missing a doctrine of the church, and it really showed up in terms of worship and ministry methodology. And I think one of the things that the Alliance was doing was sounding a big, loud trumpet sound that if we don't have a robust biblical theology of the church, it's going to mess up everything else, because people will believe what you do, not what you say. Mm-hmm. And if you say you believe in historic Christianity, but then you act a different way as the church, they'll believe what you act, not what you say. And in that day, you know, I mean, really for 100 years, evangelicalism had decided the Bible tells you the gospel, but everything else you can figure it out, make it up on your own, be entrepreneurial, do, you know, get, you know, Boyce's statement was that evangelicalism didn't understand that what you win them by, you win them to. And evangelicalism thought, as long as we give the gospel message, we can win them any way, you know, we can do P.T. Barnum and win them to Christ. And what Boyce said is, if you do P.T. Barnum, you will win them to P.T. Barnum, not to Christ. And the Alliance really started that way, Ken, you know, just trying to send that message to evangelicalism. And in a sense, the Gospel Coalition just picked up on that. And if you look at the founding documents of the Gospel Coalition, the Gospel Coalition acknowledges that all the way through, especially the sort of the vision and mission documents, it recognizes that unless you connect your doctrine of the gospel to your theology of ministry, you're going to lose the gospel with your theology of ministry if your theology of ministry doesn't flow out of the Bible and isn't consistent with the gospel. And so in a sense, the TGC, the Gospel Coalition, it grew out of a friendship. You know, I think Don Carson had admired the work that Tim Keller was doing in New York. Tim had always admired Don. They got together and started talking and saying, wouldn't it be great to have sort of a pastor's fellowship, that they were all animated by, you know, this basically Reformed theology, but also really wanting the church to do ministry in a biblical way. And that's kind of how it, you know, it grew out of that. And many of the early, you know, many of the Alliance Council members were invited to those early meetings. Phil Ryken was there. You know, it's
I went to the first one in Trinity.
Alliance Council were a part of those meetings. And so the Gospel Coalition, I think, was trying to embody that and maybe spread it a little bit further. The Alliance was really closely tied to NAPARC churches, North American Presbyterian Reformed churches, conservative Lutheran churches, solid confessional Baptist churches, some Anglicans were in there. Their ecclesiastical circles were a little bit narrower than the group that got pulled together for Gospel Coalition. And frankly, I think part of that was just Don Carson's reach. You know, Don's around the world. He works in a lot of environments. He had a lot of connections. Because he had been at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, he was really tied into the Evangelical Covenant Church, the Free Church. He was tied into some of the Northern Baptists. He was tied into the Bible Church movement. He had a very wide reach. And of course, Tim had a wide reach because he was already, you know, sort of a household name in church planning, urban church planning circles. And because of that, it was a little bit broader constituency. And look, TGC tried to reach into some constituencies that came back to haunt them.
Well, that was my next question. Because certainly we've seen the profile of those who are committed to Reformed theology historically and confessionally, we've seen an increase. The numbers in these various gatherings, you go to a Gospel Coalition meeting or Together for the Gospel event, the numbers are huge.
Yeah.
And so the issue, and it certainly is a far cry from what would have been experienced pre-ACE days.
Yeah.
Now, that being the case, with this broader base and broader appeal, my question is, at what cost?
Yeah. Well, the key, Ken, is I think you have to know what you're doing. And then you have to not let your eyes trick you. You know, just because you look out there and you see, you know, 14,000 people at Together for the Gospel in Louisville, Kentucky, you don't translate in your mind, that's 14,000 confessionally Reformed pastors. No, it's 14,000 pastors who are at least willing to listen to some guys that are confessionally Reformed, but they may or may not share all of those convictions themselves. So it's an opportunity. Our friend Mike Horton used to talk about a funnel. It's the outer edge of the funnel. You've not gotten down to the guys that are ready to identify the confessional Reformed theology, but they're willing to listen. And mm-hmm. so you have to not let your eyes trick you when you see those things. And when you come from our world, Ken, you know, most of the stuff that we do is small in the eyes of the world. We're not filling up stadiums. You know, we're right. not filling up Wembley Stadium in London with 100,000 people, or you know, Soldier Field with 80,000 people for a Billy Graham crusade rally or something like that. And so when you look out at a Gospel Coalition conference and they're 10,000 people at the women's conference and 8,000 people at the national conference and 14,000 people at Together for the Gospel, you can let that trick you into thinking you're more influential than you are. So what I always try and remember is I've got a chance to do several things. One is to let a part of the world that's not coming from my confessional Reformed perspective know that we're just not total weirdos. We're nice human beings. We like people. We want people to be happy. We're relatively happy and normal people. And then we want to, it gives me an opportunity to bless them. I hope bless them with some sound confessional Reformed theology and oftentimes exercise a healthful influence in their own life and in their own pastoral ministry. Now, I believe in Reformed theology. I tell people all the time, my little theory in life is give the Westminster Confession a chance and it will win. And so part of my goal in life is just to get the Reformed confessions out there. They're a better argument than anything that can be raised against them. And if you give them a fighting chance, they can win. They can persuade people about what the Bible is teaching. And so I love those sorts of opportunities. I don't want to confuse them with what I'm doing in my local church or what I'm doing in my denominational setting. You know, that's where my deep accountability is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And really, these kinds of networks can't give the kind of ecclesiastical accountability that you and I want and have in our own environments. And we're very thankful for that. I mean, I have elders and I have a presbytery that I'm accountable to in ways that people could never be accountable in these large evangelical movements. So I've always, for me, it's not a substitute for life in the local congregation or in my confession, in my presbytery or in my denomination. It's an opportunity to reach some people that would never, ever darken the doors of First Presbyterian Church. And to allow them to encounter some things that they might not encounter anywhere else. And I think that's what these things have done over the last 20 years. They've sort of they've broadcast, to use that old term. They've just like seed, you've broadcast it out into the yard, and it's gotten planted in some neat places. So a story I'll tell you is when I landed in Cape Town, South Africa, about, 10 years ago, I met a young man in an Assemblies of God church. He was being mentored by his Assemblies of God pastor, very large congregation in one of the townships in Cape Town. Hmm. And he came into contact with the teaching of R.C. Sproul and Jim Boyce and confessionally reformed guys. And over time, he became confessionally reformed. And his pastor was tragically murdered. You know, the townships are dangerous places.
Yeah.
And the congregation came to him after his pastor's death and said, "We want you to become the pastor of our congregation." And he said, "Oh, I can't do that." And they said, "Well, I mean, the pastor's been grooming you." And he said, I know, but I'm reformed." And they said, "Well, what's reformed?" And he tried to explain, and they didn't understand. And and finally they said, "Well, wait a second. I mean, do you still believe in Jesus?" "Yes, I do." "I mean, do you still believe the gospel at more than ever?" "Well, then we want you to be our pastor." And he said, "Well, you don't understand. I'm reformed, and I'm going to teach." Well, that church is now an independent reformed congregation. He became the pastor. And I could tell you story after story after story like that. And I think if it weren't for things like this, you know, this particular conversation that we're having right now, conferences, a lot of people like that would never be exposed to reformed theology, because we would only be, you know, sort of siloed in our own church and denominational setting. This is just a way of getting the message out. And I think that's a good thing, as long as you don't trick yourself.
No, that's very good, very, very wise advice. Don't be tricked by what you see.
Yeah.
And then I would say on the flip side of that, it's important for those who may not be a part of it to be careful in our critique, that we will see certain people as a part of this group or whatever, and they may not be fully reformed to the effort and the bridge building because of something that is held by those who attend.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You know, that sometimes we'll say, well, what is this guy doing here? And we know he's not reformed. Because there's always going to be that issue, especially for those who are new to this body of theology, that you'll never be reformed enough.
Right.
And trust me, I've been on this journey for a while, and in the eyes of some people, I'm still not reformed enough, and I'm just too old to care. You know, you know, I know from whence we have come. So I do think that it's important that for those who are looking from the outside, that we don't critique we're not overly critical of the organization because of the doctrinal impurity of those who are coming in to hear and see what's going on.
That's right.
But now in that regard, though, again, to go back to the question of, as the platform has broadened, as the profile has gotten larger, has it come at the expense of the core things that bind us together, even in terms of coalition? For instance, to go back to ACE, one of the requirements for being a part of the Council of the Alliance was you had to be committed to one of the historic confessions.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we still have that sort of boundary? Because you're talking about different denominations, different church structures or leadership structures. But is there still a commitment around the core issues of the gospel?
That's good. And you know, in the world of the Gospel Coalition, Ken, there are several things. One is every council member has to be able to affirm the foundation documents, both the theological statement and the ministry statement that were written, which I think you wouldn't find any objections to the things that are affirmed in the theology statement or the mission statement. And then beyond that, every individual member of the council confesses some kind of ecclesiastical confession that would be reformed of some sort, whether it's the London Confession or the Westminster Confession or the Three Forms of Unity or one of the historic, the New Hampshire Confession, one of the historic confessions of the church. One thing about TGC that's a challenge, though, is organizationally, TGC is larger than the Alliance and larger than Together for the Gospel. A lot of people don't know. Together for the Gospel has one employee. And everybody else is either paid part-time or volunteer for Together for the Gospel. Whereas there's a big group of young people working for TGC. And that's one of the things that happens is the council all subscribes the theological statement and the mission statement and some, but not necessarily all the writers do for TGC. And people know what they read on the website, people have no idea what the council is doing. They are all focused on the website. And we've even had some really good discussions about that recently. How do we make sure that the website actually represents the theological commitments that we have said are a part of who we are as TGC? And I think that's part of the growing pains of the organization is there is a larger structural apparatus to TGC than there ever was at the Alliance. You know, the Alliance, you had Bob Brady for many years, you know, sort of running the offices, and it was a mom and pop kind of operation. It wasn't a big, operation. And first Jim Boyce and then Mike Horton and then we all were very hands-on in relating with the staff, and we were doing several small focused things. We were rebroadcasting Dr. Barnhouse's sermons. Mm-hmm. We were rebroadcasting Dr. Boyce's sermons. We were doing PCRT conferences. We were producing Modern Reformation magazine and other things like that.
We did some pastors' conferences.
Small, frankly, back in those days, the internet was not the big thing when I started out. You know, it was by the time I finished that was as big a platform as anything we were doing in the conferences. Whereas TGC came into the world where the internet was on the rise. And now it's, I think that TGC website is the second largest or second most visited Orthodox Christian website in the world, right behind Desiring God. So Desiring God and TGC get more unique visitors per year, per month, per day than any other Orthodox website. Now, I'm sad to say, do you know what the largest supposedly Christian website is in the world?
No.
The Jehovah's Witnesses.
Get out of here.
JW.org is far and away the most visited website. So I'm thankful that things like Desiring God and TGC are out there, at least giving an Orthodox witness to the basics of evangelical Christianity. But what that means is we have to do a better job of how we present who we are through the website, because so many people just get their opinion of us through the website. So if a blogger writes some controversial blog and he's not even a council member, and people go all woo, about that. Then they go, well, TGC said, and you want to go, wait a second, he's not even a member of the TGC council, but suddenly it looks like TGC is pushing a particular issue.
Right.
But that has been, and when I get those kinds of criticisms, my attitude is totally fair. You know, have at it, pop me one in the jaw. You know, and in fact, recently I had a guy write to me and say, you know, how can you be a confessional Reformed Christian? There was an article on the website that was attacking the idea that the morality, the moral law of God, which was revealed to Adam and revealed in the form of the Ten Commandments to Moses, that's no longer applicable to Christians in a direct way. And of course, all the Reformed Protestant confessions confess that it is, every single one of them. And the early church did too. And he was saying, well, how can you be a confessional Christian, Presbyterian, and be a part of an alliance where your views are attacked? And I said, well, by the way, that guy is not even on the council. TGC, and so those are totally fair questions, Ken. And as Christians, the best way we can foster unity is to take those kinds of criticisms seriously. When a guy's trying to dodge a question like that, what does it make you? It makes you suspicious. Be able to just walk right into the question and say, "Fair enough. Here it is. Let's have a conversation about it."
Well, listen, we're going to wrap up this session, but thank you again, Lig, for the candor in which you've addressed these issues. And I think it is helpful for people to get a historical overview of where we are. Appreciate you have a better appreciation for the moment if you understand the journey. So even whatever areas of critique, whatever things that need to be refined, sure, there's nothing this side of heaven that can't be fixed.
Amen.
But I really do appreciate your broad view of this, and we will pick up our conversation shortly, but thanks again for joining us. We look forward to joining you guys next week, same time here at Saints and Sinners Unplugged. Nothing but the blood of Jesus.